Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and unless you're lucky enough to be chilling at the beach or pool this week, I know you're dealing with some hot, steamy weather. Hot and steamy. That's a genre we haven't explored before on the Book Report. So when I was offered an opportunity to speak with a pioneer on the topic of human sexuality, Dr. Ruth Westheimer, and yes, at age 85, she remains as vibrant and engaging as ever, the planets coalesced with Venus at the center. And readers, no worries, there will be no shades of gray in this show. Together, we'll rediscover classics and introduce several new titles as we turn to page one of the Book Report. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Some reference points on the roots of erotic literature, let's first explore some classics. At the top of every list is Aeneas Nin. Ready for some fascinating history? Aeneas was an American born to Spanish-Cuban parents in France. Nin spent most of her adult life in the United States. Her collection of stories, Delta of Venus, was largely written in the 1940s while Nin was writing erotica for a private collector. The book was first published posthumously in 1977. This collector commissioned Nin, along with other well-known writers, including Henry Miller, to produce erotic fiction at $1 per page for his private consumption. The stories of the Delta of Venus feature characters who reappear throughout, and the sexual themes discussed include abuse, incest, homosexuality, prostitution, and infidelity. Though the collector instructed the writers to leave poetic language aside and concentrate on graphic, sexually explicit scenarios, Nin layered images and ideas beyond the pornographic. In fact, in the introduction, she called herself the madam of this snobbish literary house of prostitution. In Delta of Venus, Nin demands that sex be mixed with tears, laughter, promises, new faces, dancing, and wine. And yes, I did try to discover who the collector was, but found no answers. Readers, if any of you know, drop me a line at elaine@bookreportradio.com. The actress Ingrid Pitt performs this groundbreaking collection of stories.
He asked if she sold luminous flowers that he had heard about, flowers which shone in the dark. He wanted them, he said, for a woman who shone in the dark. He could swear that when he took her to the theater and she sat back in the dark loge in her evening dress, her skin was as luminous as the finest seashells, with a pale pink glow to it, and he wanted these flowers for her to wear in her hair. Mathilde did not have them, but as soon as the man left, she went to look at herself in the mirror. This was the kind of feeling she wanted to inspire. Could she? Her glow was not of that nature. She was much more like fire than light. Her eyes were ardent, violet in color. Her hair was dyed blonde, but it shed a copper shadow around her. Her skin was copper-toned too, firm and not at all transparent. Her body filled her dresses tightly, richly. She didn't wear a corset, but her body had the shape of a woman who did. She arched so as to throw the breasts forward and the buttocks high. The man had come back, but this time he was not asking for anything to buy. He stood looking at her, his long, finely carved face smiling, his elegant gestures making a ritual out of lighting a cigarette, and said, "This time I came back just to see you." Mathilde's heart beat so swiftly that she felt as if this were the moment she had expected for years. She almost stood up on her toes to hear the rest of his words. She felt as if she were the luminous woman, sitting back in the dark bow, receiving the unusual flowers. The scene was repeated on several occasions. Mathilde found that when she appeared, men were usually speechless, deprived of all inclination for romantic courtship. Such words as these fell from them each time at the mere sight of her. Her effect was so direct that all they could express was their physical disturbance. Instead of accepting this as a tribute, she resented it. Now she was in the cabin of the smooth Spaniard Dalvedo. Dalvedo was peeling some cactus figs for her and talking. Mathilde was regaining confidence. She sat on the arm of the chair in her red velvet evening dress. But the peeling of the figs was interrupted. Dalvedo rose and said, "You have the most seductive little mole on your chin." She thought that he would try to kiss her, but he didn't. And Mathilde again struck, then moved towards the door. "Don't go," he begged. "You drive me crazy. Look at the state you put me in. I was like this all evening when I danced with you. You can't leave me now." As soon as Mathilde arrived in Lima, however, she attained her dream. Men approached her with flowery words, disguising their intent with great charm and adornments. This prelude to their sexual act satisfied her. She liked a little incense. In Lima, she received much of it. It was part of the ritual. She was raised on a pedestal of poetry so that her falling into the final embrace might seem more of a miracle. She sold many more of her nights.
We've just heard The Delta of Venus by Anaïs Nin. Tropic of Cancer is Henry Miller's 1934 autobiography as novel about the impoverished middle-aged writer's expatriate sojourn in Depression-era France. Banned as obscene in the U.S. until 1961, Tropic of Cancer is a mixture of memoir and fiction, chronicling with unapologetic gusto the body adventures of a young expatriate writer, his friends, and the character they meet in Paris in the 1930s. A dirty book worth reading, Ezra Pound wrote, as he went on to compare it to James Joyce's Ulysses. Prominent 1930s literati, including T.S. Eliot, John Dos Passos, Huxley, and George Orwell, joined in praising this non-literary, literary work. Tropic of Cancer is now considered, as Norman Mailer said, one of the 10 or 20 great novels of our century. Campbell Scott performs the work.
Twilight hour. Indian blue, water of glass, trees glistening and liquescent. The rails fall away into the canal at Jaurès. The long caterpillar with lacquered sides dips like a roller coaster. It is not Paris. It is not Coney Island. It is a crepuscular melange of all the cities of Europe and Central America. The railroad yards below me, the tracks black, webby, not ordered by the engineer but cataclysmic in design, like those gaunt fissures in the polar ice which the camera registers in degrees of black. Food is one of the things I enjoy tremendously. And in this beautiful Villa Borghese, there is scarcely ever any evidence of food. It is positively appalling at times. I have asked Boris time and again to order bread for breakfast, but he always forgets. He goes out for breakfast, it seems. And when he comes back, he is picking his teeth, and there is a little egg hanging from his goatee. He eats in the restaurant out of consideration for me. He says it hurts to eat a big meal and have me watch him. I like Van Norden, but I do not share his opinion of himself. I do not agree, for instance, that he is a philosopher or a thinker. And he will never be a writer. Nor will Sylvester ever be a writer, though his name blaze in 50,000 candle-power red lights. The only writers about me for whom I have any respect at present are Carl and Boris. They are possessed. They glow inwardly with a white flame. They are mad and tone-deaf. They are sufferers. Moldorf, on the other hand, who suffers too in his peculiar way, is not mad. Moldorf is word-drunk. He has no veins or blood vessels, no heart or kidneys. He is a portable trunk filled with innumerable drawers, and in the drawers are labels written out in white ink, brown ink, red ink, blue ink, vermilion, saffron, mauve, sienna, apricot, turquoise, onyx, Anjou, herring, corona, verdigris, gorgonzola. I have moved the typewriter into the next room where I can see myself in the mirror as I write. Tanya is like Irena. She expects fat letters. But there is another Tanya, a Tanya like a big seed who scatters pollen everywhere. Or let us say, a little bit of Tolstoy, a stable scene in which the fetus is dug up.
That was a sampling of Tropic of Cancer by Henry Miller. Dr. Ruth Westheimer is a psychosexual therapist who sprang to national attention in the early 80s with her live radio program, Sexually Speaking. She went on to have her own incredibly popular TV show, and she's still a popular TV personality. She's a frequent contributor to magazines and is the author of 37 books, including her latest, Dr. Ruth's Guide for the Alzheimer's Caregiver. A one-woman show about her life, Dr. Ruth All the Way, has recently opened. Dr. Ruth teaches at Columbia's Teacher College, New York. Today, we're going to speak with Dr. Ruth about sex in literature. Fiction is definitely getting more explicit. Welcome, Dr. Ruth. I'm thrilled to have you with us on the Book Report.
Thank you, Elaine. I'm glad to talk to you.
You've recently written about literature becoming much more sexually explicit.
Yes.
We've come a long way from being shocked by Lady Chatterley's Lover.
Right. You know, the funny thing is, wherever I go these days, especially a few days ago, I gave a talk to about 180 women. So after I talk a little bit, I say, so let me see a show of hands who read 50 Shades of Grey. And quite a number of people raised their hands, and I raised my hand too. Because God forbid somebody should think that I haven't read it. So the interesting thing is, Elaine, that I make a point that I say for years I have been saying it's not true that women don't get aroused by sexually explicit literature or sexually explicit movies. And, for example, we used to have Lady Chatterley's Lover. That's like 50 years ago now. We then had Fear of Flying. And now with this book that has become such a bestseller, it proves the point that women need a longer time to be aroused.
Yes.
So what I tell women, it doesn't matter if it's good literature or not. I first of all say if there are passages you don't like, it's not required reading. Turn the page. But do use it in order to get aroused, in order to put your mind on that sexual experience that you are engaging in. And, you know, something funny, when the book came out in Hebrew a few months ago, it was sold out in one day. So while we have to be, especially people like you who talk about books, you have to be careful not to say this is going to be a book that people will read 50 years from now. We have to say, use it. So I use books in order to be able to say, to make a point. For example, the Sex for Dummies, to teach about good sex. And now this, my latest book that will come out, it's not out yet, but it comes out, I'll talk to you again.
Okay.
It's called Myth of Love. These are myths from Roman and Greek stories. For example, Leda and the Swan. I'm doing that with Jerry Singerman from the University of Pennsylvania Press. And he does all of the research. He chooses the pictures, and I do the section commentary. And I have to tell you something funny, because you need something funny too. I did a book a few years ago called The Art of Arousal, taking pictures, everything that had to do with sexual arousal. I did it with Gary Tintero, who is now the director of the Art Museum in Houston. Things that I teach about sex actually don't get old. because there's always something to be taught about and to be learned about. There's a picture in there about Picasso that clearly shows a penis. So, I make it into a learning experience, but at the same time, some fun.
Right. Well, despite books like 50 Shades of Grey, do you think Americans are becoming more prudish than, let's say, 20 years ago?
No, the other way around.
Okay.
I think that we in this country have people are more sexually literate because of people like you and me talking about it, because we have the best research from Kinsey, Masters and Johnson, Dr. Helen Singer Kaplan, who trained me. And right away, I'm adding to that, we need new research. Because that research of Kinsey, Masters and Johnson is 50 years old. So we now, we need, and we don't have that because it's expensive, and we need a scientifically validated research data in order to talk more about what is needed for people to have good sex.
Hmm.
Now, I did a book called Sex Over 50 with Pierre Leroux, and that's something, it's interesting because people used not to talk about that. When you say the word prudish, I right away think about people used to say after menopause, after people can't have babies, you don't need to have sex. In the Jewish tradition, and I'm very steeped in that tradition, I wrote a book, Sexuality in the Jewish Tradition, it says that even after menopause, a man is still obligated to provide sexual satisfaction to his wife. How interesting. That shows you that sex is not just for procreation, but also for recreation.
Hmm.
They knew that the relationship is important. That's why they say you have to speak to her softly. But they also knew that in order to keep a relationship going, sex has to be part of it.
All right. Are there any classic novels you'd nominate as very stimulating and something that a woman might read to her partner?
Classical?
Yeah.
I would consider Lady Chatterley's Lover a classical.
All right.
Because it's still up there, it's still interesting, it still talks about the love affair with a gardener. But I have to tell you something. A book I did recently with Pierre is for the caretakers of Alzheimer's. That's not about sex, but of course I had to add something about sex. People would be disappointed. They would pick up a book by me and they would say, well, doesn't she talk about sex anymore? So I do talk about that, but I don't make it the major. The major emphasis in that book is that caretakers have to do something for themselves in order to be able to provide the help. They have to go out to the hairdresser, they have to use friends to be of help and so forth. I have to laugh, you know why? In the play about me, which is called Becoming Dr. Ruth, which is now at Hartford, it was in Pittsfield, I tell that when I came to this country, I didn't know English. So what I did is read romance stories, because I always needed to know, do they get married at the end? That's how I learned English. I would not say that was classical literature, but that certainly was literature that helped me, because I needed to know what is the end of it, and I couldn't just go, you know, to the end of the passage. So I learned English.
I want to ask you, how can one differentiate between using graphic sex to advance a plot versus writing pornography?
Look, pornography for me is only when it involves violence or children. Anything else, like the book we talked about, Shades of Grey, or The Lady Chatterley's Lover, in my way of thinking, is not pornography. As long as we tell people not required reading if their passages move the page, if there are passages you don't like.
All right.
Anything else that can be read, and that can be read wherever people read, on the beach coming summer, on their Kindle, whatever it is, if it helps their relationship, if it helps them to take a deep breath, take some time, learn, I'm not the only one who writes about sex, learn of what is needed to have a good sexual experience, and use it.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure to speak with you today, Dr. Ruth. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'll talk to you soon.
All righty. See you soon. Bye-bye. Okay, Dr. Ruth said we had to listen to this classic, and the book report always follows doctor's orders. The last and most famous of D.H. Lawrence's novels, Lady Chatterley's Lover, was published in 1928 and banned in England and the U.S. as pornographic. While sexually tame by today's standards, the book is memorable for Lawrence's masterful and lyrical prose, and a vibrant story that takes us boldly into the world of its characters. As the novel opens, Constance Chatterley finds herself trapped in an unfulfilling marriage to a rich aristocrat whose war wounds have left him paralyzed and impotent. After a brief but unsatisfying affair with a playwright, Lady Chatterley enjoys a passionate relationship with the gamekeeper on the family estate. As she falls in love and conceives a child, she moves from the heartless, bloodless world of the aristocracy into a vital and profound connection rooted in sexual fulfillment. John Lee performs the book.
They had been taken to Paris and Florence and Rome to breathe in art, and they had been taken also in the other direction, to The Hague and Berlin, to great socialist conventions, where the speakers spoke in every civilized tongue, and no one was abashed. The two girls, therefore, were from an early age not the least daunted by either art or ideal politics. It was their natural atmosphere. They were at once cosmopolitan and provincial, with the cosmopolitan provincialism of art that goes with pure social ideals. They had been sent to Dresden at the age of 15, for music, among other things, and they had had a good time there. They lived freely among the students, they argued with the men over philosophical, sociological, and artistic matters. They were just as good as the men themselves, only better, since they were women. And they tramped off to the forests with sturdy youths bearing guitars, twang, twang. They sang the Wandervogel songs, and they were free. Free. That was the great word. Out in the open world, out in the forests of the morning, with lusty and splendid-throated young fellows, free to do as they liked, and, above all, to say what they liked. It was the talk that mattered supremely, the impassioned interchange of talk. Love was only a minor accompaniment. Both Hilda and Constance had had their tentative love affairs by the time they were 18. The young men with whom they talked so passionately and sang so lustily and camped under the trees in such freedom wanted, of course, the love connection. The girls were doubtful, but then the thing was so much talked about, it was supposed to be so important, and the men were so humble and craving. Why couldn't a girl be queenly and give the gift of herself? So they had given the gift of themselves, each to the youth with whom she had the most subtle and intimate arguments. The arguments, the discussions, were the great thing. The lovemaking and the connection were only a sort of primitive reversion and a bit of an anticlimax. One was less in love with the boy afterwards, and a little inclined to hate him, as if he had trespassed on one's privacy and inner freedom. For, of course, being a girl, one's whole dignity and meaning in life consisted in the achievement of an absolute, a perfect, a pure and noble freedom. What else did a girl's life mean? To shake off the old and sordid connections and subjections. And however one might sentimentalize it, this sex business was one of the most ancient, sordid connections and subjections. Poets who glorified it were mostly men. Women had always known there was something better, something higher, and now they knew it more definitely than ever. The beautiful, pure freedom of a woman was infinitely more wonderful than any sexual love. The only unfortunate thing was that men lagged so far behind women in the matter. They insisted on the sex thing like dogs. And a woman had to yield. A man was like a child with his appetites. A woman had to yield him what he wanted, or like a child he would probably turn nasty and flounce away and spoil what was a very pleasant connection. But a woman could yield to a man without yielding her inner free self. That, the poets and talkers about sex did not seem to have taken sufficiently into account. A woman could take a man without really giving herself away. Certainly she could take him without giving herself into his power. Rather, she could use this sex thing to have power over him. Both sisters had had their love experience by the time the war came, and they were hurried home. Neither was ever in love with a young man unless he and she were verbally very near. That is, unless they were profoundly interested, talking to one another. The amazing, the profound, the unbelievable thrill there was in passionately talking to some really clever young man by the hour, resuming day after day for months, this they had never realized till it happened. The paradisal promise, "Thou shalt have men to talk to," had never been uttered. It was fulfilled before they knew what a promise it was.
We've just heard Lady Chatterley's Lover by D.H. Lawrence. So here's what readers have to say about this title. If you liked 50 Shades of Grey, but also insist on good writing, check the work of Sylvia Day. In this novel, Bared to You, book one of the Crossfire series, Gideon Cross dominates the story like lightning in the darkness. Beautiful, brilliant, jagged, and white-hot, the love at the center of the novel reflects the character's demons. They become mirrors that reflect each other's most private wounds and desires. Jill Redfield narrates.
One day soon, I hoped to blend right in. But for now, I still felt like a fraudulent New Yorker. I had the address and the job, but I was still wary of the subway and had trouble hailing cabs. I tried not to walk around wide-eyed and distracted, but it was hard. There was just so much to see and experience. The sensory input was astonishing. The smell of vehicle exhaust mixed with food from vendor carts, the shouts of hawkers blended with music from street entertainers, the awe-inspiring range of faces and styles and accents, the gorgeous architectural wonders, and the cars. Jesus Christ! The frenetic flow of tightly packed cars was unlike anything I'd ever seen anywhere. There was always an ambulance, patrol car, or a fire engine trying to part the flood of yellow taxis with the electronic wail of ear-splitting sirens. I was in awe of the lumbering garbage trucks that navigated tiny one-way streets and the package delivery drivers who braved the bumper-to-bumper traffic while facing rigid deadlines. Real New Yorkers cruised right through it all, their love for the city as comfortable and familiar as a favorite pair of shoes. They didn't view the steam billowing from potholes and vents in the sidewalks with romantic delight. And they didn't blink an eye when the ground vibrated beneath their feet as the subway roared by below, while I grinned like an idiot and flexed my toes. New York was a brand new love affair for me. I was starry-eyed, and it showed. So I had to really work at playing it cool as I made my way over to the building where I would be working. As far as my job went, at least, I'd gotten my way. I wanted to make a living based on my own merits, and that meant an entry-level position. Starting the next morning, I would be the assistant to Mark Garrity at Watersfield and Lehman, one of the preeminent advertising agencies in the United States. My stepfather, mega financier Richard Stanton, had been annoyed when I took the job, pointing out that if I'd been less prideful, I could have worked for a friend of his instead and reaped the benefits of that connection. "You're as stubborn as your father," he'd said. "It'll take him forever to pay off your student loans on a cop salary." That had been a major fight, with my dad unwilling to back down. "Hell, if another man's going to pay for my daughter's education," Victor Reyes had said when Stanton made the offer. I respected that. I suspected Stanton did too, although he would never admit it. I understood both men's sides, because I'd fought to pay off the loans myself, and lost. It was a point of pride for my father. My mother had refused to marry him, but he'd never wavered from his determination to be my dad in every way possible. Knowing it was pointless to get riled up over old frustrations, I focused on getting to work as quickly as possible. I'd deliberately chosen to clock the short trip during a busy time on a Monday, so I was pleased when I reached the Crossfire building, which housed Watersfield and Lehman, in less than 30 minutes. I tipped my head back and followed the line of the building all the way up to the slender ribbon of sky. The Crossfire was seriously impressive, a sleek spire of gleaming sapphire that pierced the clouds. I knew from my previous interviews that the interior on the other side of the ornate copper-framed revolving doors was just as awe-inspiring, with golden-veined marble floors and walls and brushed aluminum security desk and turnstiles. I pulled my new ID card out of the inner pocket of my pants and held it up for the two guards in black business suits at the desk. They stopped me anyway, no doubt because I was majorly underdressed. But then they cleared me through. After I completed an elevator ride up to the 20th floor, I'd have a general time frame for the whole route from door to door. Score. I was walking toward the bank of elevators when a svelte, beautifully groomed brunette caught her purse on a turnstile and upended it, spilling a deluge of change.
That was Bared to You by Sylvia Day. In Happily Ever After, New York Times bestselling author Nora Roberts invites you to meet childhood friends Parker, Emma, Laurel, and Mac, the founders of Vows, one of Connecticut's premier wedding planning companies. Parker Brown turned the quartet's childhood game of wedding day into their dream jobs. And now she is the face of Vows, the one who meets every bride's demands, keeps every event on schedule, the one who makes dreams come true, except possibly her own. Mechanic Malcolm Cavanaugh loves figuring out how things work, and Parker Brown, with her mile-long legs, is no exception. But as a good friend of Parker's brother, Mao knows that moving from minor flirtation to major hookup is a serious step. No man has rattled Parker in a long time, but the motorcycle-riding, raven-haired mechanic seems to have a knack for it. Parker's business risks have always paid off, but now she'll take the chance of a lifetime with her heart. Angela Daw narrates.
Outside, she set the packets on a table, then crossed over to take the wine out of its cooler, pour herself a glass. Then simply stood, holding the glass, looking out in the softening light over the gardens to the pretty little pond and the reflection of the willows mirrored on its surface. God, do I want some of that! Laurel bolted out, her sunny blonde hair brutally short, a new look her friend already regretted. She hadn't changed out of her uniform from her position as dessert chef at an upscale local restaurant. Her eyes, bright and blue, rolled as she poured her wine. Who knew when I changed my schedule to make our girl night we'd get a last-minute lunch reservation for 20? The kitchen was a madhouse all afternoon. Mrs. G's kitchen, now. She let out a huge groan as she dropped down to sit after hours on her feet. It's an oasis of calm that smells like heaven. What's for dinner? I didn't ask. Doesn't matter. Laurel waved it away. But if Emma and Mac are late, I'm starting without them. She spotted the stack of packets. What's all that? Something that can't start without them. Laurel, do you want to go back to New York? Laurel eyed her over the rim of her glass. Are you kicking me out? I guess I want to know what you want. If you're satisfied with how things are. You moved back for me after the accident, and I'm taking it a day at a time and I'll figure it out. Right now, not having a plan's working for me, okay? Well, she broke off as Mac and Emma came out together, laughing. Emma, she thought, so beautiful with her mass of hair curling madly, her dark, exotic eyes bright with fun. Mac, her bold red hair choppy in tufts, green eyes wickedly amused, lean and long in her jeans and black shirt. What's the joke? Laurel demanded. Men. Mac set down the plates of brioche croûte and spinach tartlets Mrs. Grady had shoved into her hands on the way through the kitchen. The two of them who thought they could arm wrestle for Emma. It was kind of sweet, Emma insisted. They were brothers and came into the shop for flowers for their mother's birthday. One thing led to the other. Guys come into the studio all the time. Mac popped a sugared red grape into her mouth from the bowl already on the table. None of them ever arm wrestle each other for a date with me. Some things never change, Laurel said, raising her glass to Emma. Some things do, Parker spoke out. She had to start, had to move. That's why I asked you all to come tonight. Emma paused as she reached for the brie. Is something wrong? No, but I wanted to talk to you all at once. Determined, Parker poured wine for Mac and Emma. Let's sit down. Uh-oh, Mac warned. No uh-ohs, Parker insisted. I want to say first, I love you all so much and have forever, and will forever. We've shared so much, good and bad, and when things were at their worst, I knew you'd be there. We're all there for each other. Emma leaned over and laid a hand on Parker's. That's what friends do. Yes, it is. I want you to know how much you mean to me, and want you to know that if any of you don't want to try what I'm about to propose, for any reason at all, it changes nothing between us. She held up a hand before anyone could speak. Let me start this way. Emma, you want your own florist business one day, right? It's always been the dream. I mean, I'm happy working in the shop, and the boss gives me a lot of leeway, but I hope down the road to have my own, but no buts yet. Mac, you've got too much talent, too much creativity to spend every day taking passport photos and posed kid shots. My talent knows no bounds, Mac said lightly, but a girl's gotta eat. You'd rather have your own photography studio. I'd rather have Justin Timberlake arm wrestling Ashton Kutcher for me, too, and it's just as likely. Laurel, you studied in New York and Paris with the aim of becoming a pastry chef. An international sensation of a pastry chef. And you've settled for working at the Willows. She swallowed a bite of her spinach tart. Well, hey, part of that settling was to be here for me after we lost Mom and Dad. I studied, Parker continued, with the goal of starting my own business.
That was Happily Ever After by Nora Roberts. Nicholas Krause's first novel, Man Walks Into a Room, was shortlisted for the LA Times Book Award, and her short fiction has been collected in Best American Short Stories. Now, The History of Love proves Krause is among our freshest literary voices. It's been decades since Leo Gursky first surrendered his heart at age 10, then wrote a book about it. He's been in love with the same person ever since. Leo believes his book is lost to time, but what he doesn't know is it has survived 60 years without him and has been an inspiration to others. The History of Love is an imaginative tale of love and loss, at once funny, mysterious, and deeply passionate. An ensemble cast performs the book.
A few months ago, I saw an ad in the paper. It said, needed, nude model for drawing class, $15 an hour. It seemed too good to be true. To have so much looked at by so many. I called the number. A woman told me to come the following Tuesday. I tried to describe myself, but she wasn't interested. Anything will do, she said. The days passed slowly. I told Bruno about it, but he misunderstood and thought I was signing up for a drawing class in order to see nude girls. He didn't want to be corrected. They show their he asked. I shrugged. And down there? After Mrs. Freed on the fourth floor died, and it took 3 days before anyone found her, Bruno and I got into the habit of checking on each other. We'd make little excuses. I ran out of toilet paper, I'd say, when Bruno opened the door. A day would pass. There would be a knock on my door. I lost my TV guide, he'd explain. And I'd go and find him mine, even though I knew his was right there where it always was on his couch. Once he came down on a Sunday afternoon. I need a cup of flour, he said. It was clumsy, but I couldn't help myself. You don't know how to cook. There was a moment of silence. Bruno looked me in the eye. What do you know? He said. I'm baking a cake. When I came to America, I knew hardly anyone, only a second cousin who was a locksmith, so I worked for him. If he had been a shoemaker, I would have become a shoemaker. If he had shoveled, I too would have shoveled. But he was a locksmith. He taught me the trade, and that's what I became. We had a little business together, and then 1 year he got TB. They had to cut his liver out, and he got a 106 temperature and died. So I took it over. I sent his wife half the profits, even after she got married to a doctor and moved to Bayside. I stayed in the business for over 50 years. It's not what I would have imagined for myself. And yet, the truth is I came to like it. I helped those in who were locked out. Others I helped keep out what couldn't be let in, so that they could sleep without nightmares. Then, one day, I was looking out the window. Maybe I was contemplating the sky. Put even a fool in front of the window and you'll get a Spinoza. The afternoon passed, darkness sifted down. I reached for the chain on the bulb, and suddenly, it was as if an elephant had stepped on my heart. I fell to my knees. I thought, I didn't live forever. A minute passed, another minute, another. I clawed at the floor, pulling myself along toward the phone. 25% of my heart muscle died. It took time to recover, and I never went back to work. A year went by. I was aware of time passing for the sake of itself. I stared out the window. I watched fall turn into winter, winter into spring. Some days, Bruno came downstairs to sit with me. We've known each other since we were boys. We went to school together. He was one of my closest friends, with thick glasses, reddish hair that he hated, and a voice that cracked when he was emotional. I didn't know he was still alive, and then one day, I was walking down East Broadway and I heard his voice. I turned around. His back was to me. He was standing in front of the grocers asking for the price of some fruit. I thought, you're hearing things. You're such a dreamer. What is the likelihood? Your boyhood friend? I stood frozen on the sidewalk. He's in the ground, I told myself. Here you are in the United States of America. There's McDonald's. Get a grip. I waited just to make sure. I wouldn't have recognized his face. But the way he walked was unmistakable. He was about to pass me. I put my arm out. I didn't know what I was doing. Maybe I was seeing things. I grabbed his sleeve. Bruno, I said. He stopped and turned. At first he seemed scared and then confused. Bruno! He looked at me. His eyes began to fill with tears. I grabbed his other hand. I had one sleeve and one hand. Bruno! He started to shake. He touched his hand to my cheek. We were in the middle of the sidewalk. People were hurrying past. It was a warm day in June. His hair was thin and white. He dropped the fruit. Bruno. A couple of years later, his wife died. It was too much to live in the apartment without her. Everything reminded him. So when an apartment opened up in the floor above me, he moved in. We often sit together at my kitchen table. The whole afternoon might go by without our saying a word. If we do talk, we never speak in Yiddish. The words of our childhood became strangers to us. We couldn't use them in the same way, and so we chose not to use them at all. Life demanded a new language. Bruno, my old faithful. I haven't sufficiently described him. Is it enough to say he is indescribable? No. Better to try and fail than not to try at all. The soft down of your white hair lightly playing about your scalp like a half-blown dandelion. Many times, Bruno, I have been tempted to blow on your head and make a wish. Only a last scrap of decorum keeps me from it. Or perhaps I should begin with your height, which is very short. On a good day, you barely reach my chest. Or shall I start with the eyeglasses you fished out of a box and claimed as your own, enormous round things that magnify your eyes so that your permanent response appears to be a 4.5 on the Richter? They're women's glasses, Bruno. I've never had the heart to tell you. Many times I've tried. And something else. When we were boys, you were the greater writer. I had too much pride to tell you then. But I knew. Believe me when I say, I knew it then as I know it now. It pains me to think how I never told you. And also to think of all you could have been. Forgive me, Bruno, my oldest friend, my best. I haven't done you justice.
That was The History of Love by Nicole Krauss. In Samantha Young's On Dublin Street, Jocelyn leaves her tragic past behind in the States and starts over in Scotland, burying her grief, ignoring her demons, and forging ahead without attachments. Her solitary life is working well, until she moves into a new apartment on Dublin Street, where she meets a man who shakes her carefully guarded world to its core. Braden Carmichael is used to getting what he wants, and he's determined to get Jocelyn. Knowing how skittish she is about entering a relationship, Braden proposes an arrangement that will satisfy their intense attraction without any strings attached. But after an intrigue Jocelyn accepts, she realizes Braden won't be satisfied with passion. The Scotsman is intent on knowing her down to her soul. Paula Costello narrates.
I'd spent the last 2 weeks answering ads from young women looking for a female roommate. It had been a bust so far. One girl didn't want to room with an American. Cue my face. Three of the apartments were just nasty. I'm pretty sure one girl was a crack dealer, and the last girl's apartment sounded like it got more use than a brothel. I was really hoping my appointment today with Ellie Carmichael was going to go my way. It was the most expensive apartment I'd scheduled to see, and it was on the other side of the city center. I was frugal when it came to my inheritance, as if spending as little of it as possible would somehow lessen the bitterness of my good fortune. But I was getting desperate. If I wanted to be a writer, I needed the right apartment and the right roommate. Living alone was an option, of course. I could afford it. However, the God's honest truth was that I didn't like the idea of complete solitude. Despite my tendency to keep 80% of myself to myself, I liked being surrounded by people. When they talked to me about things I didn't understand personally, it allowed me to see things from their point of view. And I believed all the best writers needed a wide open scope of perspective. Despite not needing to, I worked at a bar on George Street on Thursday and Friday nights. The old cliche was true. Bartenders overhear all the best stories. I was friends with two of my colleagues, Joe and Craig. But we only really hung out when we were working. If I wanted a little life around me, I needed to get a roommate. On the plus side, this apartment was mere streets away from my job. As I tried to shove down the anxiety of finding a new place, I kept my eye open for a cab with its light on. I eyed the ice cream parlor, wishing I had time to stop in and indulge, and almost missed the cab coming toward me on the opposite side of the street. Throwing my hand out and checking my side for traffic, I was gratified that the driver had seen me and pulled up to the curb. I tore across the wide road, managing not to get squashed like a green and white bug against some poor person's windshield, and rushed toward the cab with a single-minded determination to grab the door handle. Instead of the door handle, I grabbed a hand. Bemused, I followed the tan, masculine hand up a long arm to broad shoulders and a face obscured by the sun beaming down behind his head. Tall, over 6 feet, the guy towered above me. I was a smallish 5'5". I took in his expensive suit, wondering why this guy had his hand on my cab. A sigh escaped from his shadowed face. "Which way are you headed?" he asked me in a rumbling, gravelly voice. 4 years I'd been living here, and still a smooth Scots accent could send a shiver down my spine. And his definitely did, despite the terse question. "Dublin Street," I answered automatically, hoping I had a longer distance to travel so that he'd give me the cab.
"Good."
He pulled the door open.
"I'm heading in that direction. And since I'm already running late, might I suggest we share the taxi instead of wasting 10 minutes deciding who needs it more?"
A warm hand touched my lower back and pressed me gently forward. Dazed, I somehow let myself be manhandled into the cab, sliding across the seat and buckling up as I silently questioned whether I'd nodded my agreement to this. I didn't think I had. Hearing the suit clip out Dublin Street as the destination to the cab driver, I frowned and muttered, "Thanks, I guess."
"You're an American."
At the soft question, I finally looked over at the passenger beside me.
"Oh, okay. Wow."
Perhaps in his late 20s or early 30s, the suit wasn't classically handsome, but there was a twinkle in his eye and a curl to the corner of his sensual mouth that, together with the rest of the package, oozed sex appeal. I could tell from the lines of the extremely well-tailored, expensive, silver-gray suit that he wore that he worked out. He sat with the ease of a fit guy, his stomach ironed flat under the waistcoat and white shirt. His pale blue eyes seemed bemused beneath their long lashes. And for the life of me, I couldn't get over the fact that he had dark hair. I preferred blondes, always had. Yet, none of them had ever made my lower belly squeeze with lust at first sight.
That was On Dublin Street by Samantha Young. Spanning the Middle Ages to the present, Marilyn Yalom's How the French Invented Love, 900 Years of Passion and Romance, explores a love-obsessed culture through its great works of literature. Yalom, a senior scholar at the Institute for Women and Gender at Stanford, finds that love occupies an honored place in the French sense of identity, on par with fashion, food, wine, and the rights of man. For hundreds of years, the French have championed themselves as guides to the art of love through their literature, painting, songs, and cinema. Yet no English book has seriously addressed the subject of French ideas of love. Yalom distills her readings of French literary works and the memories of her experiences in France to discover the central tenets of that culture's gospel of love. In the process, she examines almost 1,000 years of culture in search of the intimate moments that reveal how the French concept of l'amour has endured and evolved. Christine Williams narrates.
My French friend Marianne married Pierre in 1977. Soon after a divorce that gave her sole custody of her twin daughters. She was 29 at the time, and Pierre was 49. Pierre's sister Jeanne warned him that with such an age difference, he was likely to become a cuckold. Pierre responded that if that time were to come, he would survey the field of available men and choose a lover for his wife. Marianne did not wait for Pierre to find her a lover. Some 15 years into their marriage, she fell in love with Stéphane, a Frenchman of her own age. Stéphane and Marianne did their best to keep their affair secret, but she was seen once too often exiting his apartment, and word got back to Pierre, who was at first incredulous and then enraged. He confronted his wife, asking her to choose between him and her lover. Deeply attached to Pierre, who had helped raise her daughters, but madly in love with Stéphane, she was torn between the two men and could not leave one or the other. Eventually, she turned to Pierre's sister, Jeanne, begging her to negotiate an arrangement. She would stay in the marriage until death, if she were allowed to be out of the house with no questions asked from 4 to 7 o'clock every day except Sunday. After many hours of painfully frank talk, Pierre swallowed his pride and accepted her terms. They stayed married for another 12 years, until Pierre became terminally ill, whereupon Marianne nursed him faithfully until he died. She grieved him sincerely, and then moved in with Stéphane. It is, I believe, a quintessentially French story. Since I knew all the parties concerned, I can say that they carried it off with great dignity. Marianne never spoke to me or to anyone else about the arrangement. I heard it from Jeanne. Although most of the people in their circle knew that Marianne and Stéphane were lovers, no one ever mentioned it. Everyone kept up appearances following the etiquette of their upper bourgeois social class. How is it that Marianne, Pierre, and Stéphane were able to live out this unconventional scenario? Where in French history do we find the origins of such behavior? My mind immediately jumps back to the Middle Ages, to the fervent love stories of Lancelot and Guinevere, and Tristan and Isolde, and other tales of women halved between their husbands and their lovers. If this topos is by now a stock theme, incarnated in such world-famous novels as Madame Bovary and Anna Karenina, we should not forget that adultery as a literary subject first became fashionable in 12th century France. Yes, we are talking about the same century that encompassed the real-life history of Abélard and Héloïse. In real life, medieval women were subject to male authority, be it the rule of the father, the husband, or the priest. Remember how Héloïse submitted to absolute decisions made by her uncle and her teacher-lover husband. Under Abélard's tutelage, she was initiated into sex and love. At his insistence, she went to Brittany to have her baby and gave him up to the care of Abélard's family. She married Abélard in secret, despite her reservations about marriage, and she complied with his order to hide out in the convent where she had been raised. She even took the veil at his behest, though she had no sense of a religious vocation. Even such a remarkable woman as Héloïse bowed to the dictates of men. This was undoubtedly the case for almost all medieval women, be they peasants or princesses. Unlike the marriage of Abélard and Héloïse, most marriages among the nobility and upper bourgeoisie had nothing to do with love. In fact, the very suspicion of love between the unmarried was heavily censured, given the belief that love, amour in Old French, was an irrational, destructive force. Marriages among the privileged classes were arranged by families in the interest of property and desired kinship, rather than by the future spouses themselves. Girls as young as 13 or 14, but usually 15 to 17, were married off to men of their same social condition, who were generally 5 to 15 years older. But in literature and song, things could be different. 12th century lyric poetry and verse narratives responded to the fantasies of women as well as men, especially when women were patrons of the arts, a role they acquired increasingly in regional courts.
We've just heard How the French Invented Love by Marilyn Yalom. As Dr. Ruth says, and quite forcefully, if we find a book is too explicit and we find it distasteful, we can close the cover or turn the page. We're in control. Indeed we are. But if you'd like suggestions on books to add to your list, make sure to check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining us today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.